is accorded human status. Mortimer Adler, the American philosopher and educator, proposed essentially the same criterion in order to challenge not just the feasibility of humanoids, but also the entire philosophy of materialism. We cannot accept a thoroughly material basis for human existence, he said, until such an artificial being is created. Turing thought the humanoid could be built within a few years. Adler, a devout Christian, arrived at the same conclusion as Descartes. No such machine will ever be possible. Scientists, when told something is impossible, as a habit, set out to do it. It is not, however, their purpose to search for the ultimate meaning of existence in their experiments. Their response to cosmic inquiry is most likely to be, "What you suggest is not a productive question." Their occupation is instead exploration of the universe in concrete steps, one at a time. Their greatest reward is occasionally to reach the summit of some improbable peak, and from there, like Keats Cortez at Darien, look in wild surmise upon the vastness beyond. In their ethos, it is better to have begun a great journey than to have finished it, better to make a seminal discovery than to put the final touches on a theory. The scientific field of artificial intelligence, AI for short, was inaugurated in the 1950s, hard upon the invention of the first electronic computers. It is defined by its practitioners as the study of computation needed for intelligent behavior and the attempt to duplicate that behavior using computers. A half century of work has yielded some impressive results. Programs are available that recognize objects and faces from a few select features and at different angles, drawing on rules of geometric symmetry in the manner of human cognition. Others can translate languages, albeit crudely, or generalize and classify novel objects on the basis of cumulative experience, much in the manner of the human mind. Some programs can scan and choose options for particular courses of action according to pre-selected goals. In 1996, Deep Blue, an advanced chess-playing computer, earned grandmaster status by narrowly losing a six-game match to Garry Kasparov, the reigning human world champion. Deep Blue works by brute force, using 32 microprocessors to examine 200 million chess positions each second. It finally lost because it lacked Kasparov's ability to assess an opponent's weakness and plan long-term strategy based in part on deception. In 1997, a reprogrammed and improved Deep Blue narrowly defeated Kasparov. The first game to Kasparov, the second to Deep Blue, then three ties, and the final game to Deep Blue. The search is on for quantum advances in the simulation of all domains of human thought. In evolutionary computation, AI programmers have incorporated an organism-like procedure in the evolution of design. They provide the computers with a range of options in solving problems, then let them select and modify the available procedures to be followed. By this means, the machines have come to resemble bacteria and other simple one-celled organisms. A truly Darwinian twist can be added by placing elements in the machines that mutate at random to change the available procedures. The programs then compete to solve problems, such as gaining access to food and space. Which mutated programs will be born and which among the neonates will succeed are not always predictable, so the species of machines as a whole can evolve in ways not anticipated by the human designer. It is within the reach of computer scientists to create mutable robots that travel about the laboratory, learn and classify real resources, and thwart other robots in attaining their goals. At this level, their programs would be close to the instinctive repertories, not of bacteria, but of simple, multicellular animals such as flatworms and snails. In 50 years, the computer scientists, if successful, will have traversed the equivalent of hundreds of millions of years of organic evolution. But for all that advance, no AI enthusiast claims to have a roadmap from flatworm instinct to the human mind. How might such an immense gap be closed? There are two schools of thought. One, represented by Rodney Brooks of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, takes a bottom-up approach. In this version, the designers would follow the Darwinian robot model to higher and higher levels, gaining new insights and elaborating technology along the way. It is possible that in time, humanoid capability might emerge. The other approach is top-down. Favored by Marvin Minsky, a founding father of AI and colleague of Brooks at MIT, it concentrates directly on the highest order phenomena of learning and intelligence as they might be conceived and built into a machine without intervening evolutionary steps. In the teeth of all pessimistic assessments of human limitation likely to be raised, human genius is unpredictable and capable of stunning advances. In the near future, a capacity for at least a crude simulation of the human mind might be attained, comprising a level of brain sciences sophisticated enough to understand the basic operations of the mind fully, with computer technology advanced enough to imitate it. We might wake up one morning to find such a triumph announced in the New York Times, perhaps along with a generic cure for cancer, or the discovery of living organisms on Mars. But I seriously doubt that any such event will ever occur, and I believe a great majority of AI experts are inclined to agree. There are two reasons, which can be called, respectively, the functional obstacle and the evolutionary obstacle. The functional obstacle is the overwhelming complexity of inputs of information to and through the human mind. Rational thought emerges from continuous exchanges between body and brain through nerve discharges and blood-borne flow of hormones, influenced in turn by emotional controls that regulate mental set, attention, and the selection of goals. In order to duplicate the mind in a machine, it will not be nearly enough to perfect the brain sciences and AI technology, because the simulation pioneers must also invent and install an entirely new form of computation, artificial emotion, or AE. The second, or evolutionary, obstacle to the creation of a humanoid mind is the unique genetic history of the human species. Generic human nature, the psychic unity of mankind, is the product of millions of years of evolution in environments now mostly forgotten. Without detailed attention to the hereditary blueprint of human nature, the simulated mind might be awesome in power, but it would be more nearly that of some alien visitor, not of a human. And even if the blueprint were known, and even if it could be followed, it would serve only as a beginning. To be human, the artificial mind must imitate that of an individual person, with its memory banks filled by a lifetime's experience, visual, auditory, chemoreceptive, tactile, and kinesthetic, all freighted with nuances of emotion. And social. There must be intellectual and emotional exposure to countless human contacts. And with these memories, there must be meaning, the expanse of connections made to each and every word and bit of sensory information given the programs. Without all these tasks completed, the artificial mind is fated to fail Turing's test. Any human jury could tear away the pretense of the machine in minutes. Either that, or certifiably commit it to a psychiatric institution. Chapter 7. From Genes to Culture. The natural sciences have constructed a webwork of causal explanation that runs all the way from quantum physics to the brain sciences and evolutionary biology. There are gaps in this fabric of unknown breadth, and many of the strands composing it are as delicate as spider's silk. Predictive syntheses, the ultimate goal of science, are still in an early stage, and especially so in biology. Yet I think it fair to say that enough is known to justify confidence in the principle of universal rational consilience across all the natural sciences. The explanatory network now touches the edge of culture itself. It has reached the boundary that separates the natural sciences on one side from the humanities and humanistic social sciences on the other. Granted, for most scholars, the two domains, commonly called the scientific and literary cultures, still have a look of permanence about them. From Apollonian law to Dionysian spirit, prose to poetry, left cortical hemisphere to right, the line between the two domains can be easily crossed back and forth, but no one knows how to translate the tongue of one into that of the other. Should we even try? I believe so, and for the best of reasons. The goal is both important and attainable. The time has come to reassess the boundary. Even if that perception is disputed, and it will be, few can deny that the division between the two cultures is a perennial source of misunderstanding and conflict. This polarization is sheer loss to us all, wrote C.P. Snow in his defining 1959 essay, The Two Cultures and the Scientific Revolution. To us as people and to our society, it is at the same time practical and intellectual and creative loss. The polarization promotes, for one thing, the perpetual recycling of the nature-nurture controversy, spinning off mostly sterile debates on gender, sexual preferences, ethnicity, and human nature itself. The root cause of the problem is as obvious today as it was when Snow ruminated on it at Christ College High Table, the over-specialization of the educated elite. Public intellectuals, and trailing close behind them, the media professionals, have been trained almost without exception in the social sciences and humanities. They consider human nature to be their province, and have difficulty conceiving the relevance of the natural sciences to social behavior and policy. Natural scientists, whose expertise is diced into narrow compartments with little connection to human affairs, are indeed ill-prepared to engage the same subjects. What does a biochemist know of legal theory and the China trade? It is not enough to repeat the old nostrum that all scholars, natural and social scientists, and humanists alike, are animated by a common creative spirit. They are indeed creative siblings, but they lack a common language. There is only one way to unite the great branches of learning and end the culture wars. It is to view the boundary between the scientific and literary cultures not as a territorial line, but as a broad and mostly unexplored terrain awaiting cooperative entry from both sides. The misunderstandings arise from ignorance of the terrain, not from a fundamental difference in mentality. The two cultures share the following challenge. We know that virtually all of human behavior is transmitted by culture. We also know that biology, has an important effect on the origin of culture and its transmission. The question remaining is how biology and culture interact, and in particular, how they interact across all societies to create the commonalities of human nature. What, in final analysis, joins the deep, mostly genetic history of the species as a whole to the more recent cultural histories of its far-flung societies? That, in my opinion, is the nub of the relationship between the two cultures. It can be stated as a problem to be solved, the central problem of the social sciences and the humanities, and simultaneously, one of the great remaining problems of the natural sciences. At the present time, no one has a solution. But in the sense that no one in 1842 knew the true cause of evolution, and in 1952 no one knew the nature of the genetic code, the way to solve the problem may lie within our grasp. A few researchers, and I am one of them, even think they know the approximate form the answer will take. From diverse vantage points in biology, psychology, and anthropology, they have conceived a process called gene-culture coevolution. In essence, the conception observes, first, that to genetic evolution, the human lineage has added the parallel track of cultural evolution, and second, that the two forms of evolution are linked. I believe the majority of contributors to the theory during the past 20 years would agree to the following outline of its principles. Culture is created by the communal mind, and each mind, in turn, is the product of the genetically structured human brain. Genes and culture are therefore inseparably linked, but the linkage is flexible, to a degree still mostly unmeasured. The linkage is also tortuous. Genes prescribe epigenetic rules, which are the neural pathways and regularities in cognitive development by which the individual mind assembles itself. The mind grows from birth to death by absorbing parts of the existing culture available to it, with selections guided through epigenetic rules inherited by the individual brain. To visualize gene-culture coevolution more concretely, consider the example of snakes and dream serpents, which I used earlier to argue the plausibility of complete consilience. The innate tendency to react with both fear and fascination towards snakes is the epigenetic rule. The culture draws on that fear and fascination to create metaphors and narratives. The process is thus. As part of gene-culture coevolution, culture is reconstructed each generation collectively in the minds of individuals. When oral tradition is supplemented by writing and art, culture can grow indefinitely large and it can even skip generations. But the fundamental biasing influence of the epigenetic rules, being genetic and ineradicable, stays constant. Hence the prominence of dream serpents in the legends and art of the Amazonian shamans enriches their culture across generations under the guidance of the serpentine epigenetic rule. Some individuals inherit epigenetic rules, enabling them to survive and reproduce better in the surrounding environment and culture than individuals who lack those rules, or at least possess them in weaker valence. By this means, over many generations, the more successful epigenetic rules have spread through the population along with the genes that prescribe the rules. As a consequence, the human species has evolved genetically by natural selection and behavior, just as it has in the anatomy and physiology of the brain. Poisonous snakes have been an important source of mortality in almost all societies throughout human evolution. Close attention to them, enhanced by dream serpents and the symbols of culture, undoubtedly improves the chances of survival. The nature of the genetic leash and the role of culture can now be better understood as follows. Certain cultural norms also survive and reproduce better than competing norms, causing culture to evolve in a track parallel to, and usually much faster, than genetic evolution. The quicker the pace of cultural evolution, the looser the connection between genes and culture, although the connection is never completely broken. Culture allows a rapid adjustment to changes in the environment through finely tuned adaptations invented and transmitted without correspondingly precise genetic prescription. In this respect, human beings differ fundamentally from all other animal species. Finally, to complete the example of gene culture coevolution, the frequency with which dream serpents and serpent symbols inhabit a culture is seen to be adjusted to the abundance of real poisonous snakes in the environment. But owing to the power of fear and fascination given them by the epigenetic rule, they easily acquire additional mythic meaning. They serve in different cultures variously as healers, messengers, demons, and gods. Gene culture coevolution is a special extension of the more general process of evolution by natural selection. Biologists generally agree that the primary force behind evolution in human beings and all other organisms is natural selection. That is what created Homo sapiens during the 5 or 6 million years after the ancestral hominid species split off from a primitive chimpanzee-like stock. Evolution by natural selection is not an idle hypothesis. The genetic variation on which selection acts is well understood in principle all the way down to the molecular level. Evolution watchers among field biologists have monitored evolution by natural selection generation by generation in natural populations of animals and plants. The result can often be reproduced in the laboratory, even up to the creation of new species, for example, by hybridization and the breeding of reproductively isolated strains. The manner in which traits of anatomy, physiology, and behavior adapt organisms to their environment has been massively documented. The fossil hominid record, from man-apes to modern humans, while still lacking many details, is solid in main outline with a well-established chronology. In simplest terms, evolution by natural selection proceeds, as the French biologist Jacques Monod once put it, rephrasing Democritus, by chance and necessity. Different forms of the same gene, called alleles, originate by mutations, which are random changes in the long sequences of DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, that compose the gene. In addition to such point-by-point scrambling of the DNA, new mixes of alleles are created each generation by the recombining processes of sexual reproduction. The alleles that enhance survival and reproduction of the carrier organisms spread through the population, while those that do not disappear. Chance mutations are the raw material of evolution. Environmental challenge, deciding which mutants and their combinations will survive, is the necessity that molds us further from this protean genetic clay. If given enough generations, mutations and recombination can generate a nearly infinite amount of hereditary variation among individuals in a population. For example, if even a mere 1,000 genes out of the 50,000 to 100,000 in the human genome were to exist in two forms in the population, the number of genetic combinations conceivable is 10 to the 500th power, more than all the atoms in the visible universe. So, except for identical siblings, the probability that any two human beings share identical genes, or have ever shared them throughout the history of the hominid line, is vanishingly small. With each generation, the chromosomes and genes of the parents are scrambled to produce new mixes. But this perpetual shearing and reconfiguration does not of itself cause evolution. The consistent guiding force is natural selection. Genes that confer higher survival and reproductive success on the organisms bearing them, through the prescribed traits of anatomy, physiology, and behavior, increase in the population from one generation to the next. Those that do not, decrease. Similarly, populations or even entire species with higher survival and reproductive success prevail over competing populations or species to the same general end in evolution. Such is the impersonal force that evidently made us what we are today. All of biology, from molecular to evolutionary, points that way. At the risk of seeming defensive, I am obliged to acknowledge that many people, some very well educated, prefer special creation as an explanation for the origin of life. According to a poll conducted by the National Opinion Research Center in 1994, 23% of Americans reject the idea of human evolution, and a third more are undecided. This pattern is unlikely to change radically in the years immediately ahead. Because I was raised in a predominantly anti-evolutionist culture in the Protestant southern United States, I am inclined to be empathetic to these feelings and conciliatory. Anything is possible, it can be said, if you believe in miracles. Perhaps God did create all organisms, including human beings, in finished form, in one stroke, and maybe it all happened several thousand years ago. But if that is true, he also salted the earth with false evidence in such endless and exquisite detail, and so thoroughly from pole to pole, as to make us conclude, first, that life evolved, and second, that the process took billions of years. Surely Scripture tells us he would not do that. The prime mover of the Old and New Testaments is variously loving, magisterial, denying, thunderously angry, and mysterious, but never tricky. Virtually all biologists closely familiar with the details find the evidence for human evolution compelling and give natural selection the commanding role. There is at least one other force, however, that must be mentioned in any account of evolution. By chance alone, the biologists agree, substitutions are occurring through long stretches of time in some of the DNA letters and the proteins they encode. The continuity of change is often smooth enough to measure the age of different evolving lines of organisms. But this genetic drift, as it is called, adds very little to evolution at the level of cells, organisms, and societies. The reason is that the mutants involved in drift have proven to be neutral, or nearly so. They have little or no effect on the higher levels of biological organization manifest in cells and organisms. To genetic evolution, putting the matter as concisely as possible, natural selection has added the parallel track of cultural evolution, and the two forms of evolution are somehow linked. We are trapped, we sometimes think, for ultimate good or evil, not just by our genes, but also by our culture. What precisely is this superorganism, this strange creature called culture? To anthropologists, who have analyzed thousands of examples, should go the privilege of response. For them, a culture is the total way of life of a discrete society, its religion, myths, art, technology, sports, and all the other systematic knowledge transmitted across generations. In 1952, Alfred Kroeber and Clyde Cluckhohn melded 164 prior definitions pertaining to all cultures into one as follows. Culture is a product, is historical, includes ideas, patterns, and values, is selective, is learned, is based upon symbols, and is an abstraction from behavior and the products of behavior. As Kroeber had earlier declared, it is also holistic, an accommodation of discrete parts, largely inflowing parts, into a more or less workable fit. Among the parts are artifacts, but these physical objects have no significance except when addressed as concepts in living minds. In the extreme nurturist view, which has prevailed in social theory for most of the 20th century, culture has departed from the genes and become a thing unto itself, possessing a life of its own. Growing like wildfire ignited by the strike of a match, it has acquired emergent properties no longer connected to the genetic and psychological processes that initiated it. Hence, omnis cultura, ex cultura. All culture comes from culture. Whether that metaphor is accepted or not, the undeniable truth is that each society creates culture and is created by it. Through constant grooming, decorating, exchange of gifts, sharing of food and fermented beverages, music and storytelling, the symbolic communal life of the mind takes form, unifying the group into a dream world that masters the external reality into which the group has been thrust, whether in forest, grassland, desert, ice field, or city, spinning from it the webs of moral consensus and ritual that bind each tribal member to the common fate. Culture is constructed with language that is productive, comprising arbitrary words and symbols invented purely to convey information. In this respect, Homo sapiens is unique. Animals have communication systems that are sometimes impressively sophisticated, but they neither invent them nor teach them to others. With a few exceptions, such as bird song dialects, they are instinctive, hence unchanging across generations. The waggle dance of the honeybee and the odor trails of ants contain symbolic elements, but the performances and meanings are tightly prescribed by genes and cannot be altered by learning. Among animals, true linguistic capacity is most closely approached by the great apes. Chimpanzees and gorillas can learn the meanings of arbitrary symbols when trained to use signaling keyboards. Their champion is Kanzi, a bonobo or pygmy chimpanzee, Pan Paniscus, arguably the smartest animal ever observed in captivity. I met this primate genius when he was a precocious youngster at the Yerkes Regional Primate Center of Emory University in Atlanta. He had been studied intensively since birth by Sue Savage Rumbaugh and her colleagues. As I played games and shared a cup of grape juice with him, I was more than a bit disoriented by his general demeanor, which I found uncannily close to that of a human 2-year-old. More than a decade later, as I write, the adult Kanzi has acquired a large vocabulary with which he signals his wishes and intentions on a picture symbol keyboard. He constructs sentences that are lexically, if not grammatically, correct. On one occasion, for example, ice water go, bring me some ice water, got him the drink. He has even managed to pick up about 150 spoken English words spontaneously, listening to conversation among humans without the kind of training needed by border collies and other smart breeds of dogs to go through their many tricks. On another occasion, Savage Rumbaugh, pointing to a companion chimpanzee nearby, said, "Kanzi, if you give Austin your mask, I'll let you have some of Austin's cereal." Kanzi promptly gave Austin the mask and pointed to the cereal box. He has acted upon words in a focused and specific manner too frequently for the connection to be due to chance alone. Even so, Kanzi uses only words and symbols supplied him by human beings. His linguistic powers have not yet risen to the level of early human childhood. Bonobos and other great apes possess high levels of intelligence by animal standards, but lack the singular human capacity to invent rather than merely to use symbolic language. It is further true that common chimpanzees are human-like in guile and deception, the animal masters of Machiavellian intelligence. As Franz de Waal and his fellow primatologists have observed in the African wild and the Arnhem Zoo in the Netherlands, they form and break coalitions, manipulate friends, and outwit enemies. Their intentions are conveyed by voiced signals and postures, body movements, facial expressions, and the bristling of fur. But in spite of the great advantage a productive human-like language would bestow, chimpanzees never create anything resembling it, or any other form of free-ranging symbolic language. In fact, the great apes are completely silent most of the time. The primatologist Alan Gardner described his experience in Tanzania as follows. A group of 10 wild chimpanzees of assorted ages and sexes feeding peacefully in a fig tree at Gombe may make so little sound that an inexperienced observer passing below can altogether fail to detect them. Homo sapiens, by contrast, can rightfully be called the babbling ape. Humans communicate vocally all the time. It is far easier to start them talking than to shut them up. They begin in infancy, during exchanges with adults, who urge them on with the slow, vowel-heavy, emotionally exaggerated sing-song called motherese. Left alone, they continue with crib speech, composed of squeaks, coos, and nonsense monosyllables, which evolve over a few months into a complex play of words and phrases. These early verbal repertories, conforming more or less to adult vocabularies, are repeated ad nauseam, modified, and combined in experimental mixtures. By the age of 4, the average child has mastered syntax. By 6, in the United States at least, he has a vocabulary of about 14,000 words. In contrast, young bonobos play and experiment freely with movements and sounds, and sometimes with symbols, but so far, progress toward the Kanzi level depends on the rich linguistic environment provided by human trainers. Even if the great apes lack true language, is it possible they possess culture? From evidence in the field, it appears they do, and many expert observers have so concluded. Wild chimps regularly invent and use tools, and the particular kinds of artifacts they invent, just as in human culture, are often limited to local populations. Where one group breaks nuts open with a rock, another cracks them against tree trunks. Where some groups use twigs to fish ants and termites from the nests for food, others do not. Among those that fish, a minority first peel the bark off the twigs. One chimp group has been observed using long, hooked branches to pull down branches of fig trees to obtain fruit. It is natural to conclude from such observations that chimpanzees have the rudiments of culture, and to suppose that their capability differs from human culture by degree alone. But that perception needs to be accepted with caution. Chimpanzee inventions may not be culture in any sense. The still scanty evidence on the subject suggests that while chimps pick up the use of a tool more quickly when they see others using one, they seldom imitate the precise movements employed or show any clear sign of understanding the purpose of the activity. Some observers have gone so far as to claim that they are merely stirred into greater activity by watching others. This kind of response, which zoologists call social facilitation, is common in many kinds of social animals, from ants to birds and mammals. Although the evidence is inconclusive, social facilitation alone, combined with trial-and-error manipulation of materials conveniently at hand, might guide the chimps to tool-using behavior in the free-ranging African populations. Human infants, on the other hand, do engage in precise imitation and with astonishing precocity. As early as 40 minutes after birth, to cite the ultimate example, they stick out their tongues and move their heads from side to side in close concert with adults. By 12 days, they imitate complex facial expressions and hand gestures. By 2 years, they can be verbally instructed in the use of simple tools. In summary, the language instinct consists of precise mimicry, compulsive loquacity, near-automatic mastery of syntax, and the swift acquisition of a large vocabulary. The instinct is a diagnostic and evidently unique human trait based upon a mental power beyond the reach of any animal species, and it is the precondition for true culture. To learn how language originated during evolution would be a discovery of surpassing importance. Unfortunately, the evidences of behavior rarely fossilize. All the millennia of campsite chattering and gesticulation, and with them all the linguistic steps up from our chimp-like ancestors, have vanished without trace. What paleontologists have instead are fossil bones, which tell of the downward migration and lengthening of the voice box, as well as possible changes in the linguistic regions of the brain impressed upon the inner cranial case. They also have steadily improving evidence of the evolution of artifacts from the controlled use of fire 450,000 years ago, presumably by the ancestral species Homo erectus, to the construction of well-wrought tools by early Homo sapiens 250,000 years ago in Kenya. Then elaborate spearheads and daggers 160,000 years later in the Congo. And finally, elaborate painting and the accoutrements of ritual 30,000 and 20,000 years ago in southern Europe. This pace in the evolution of artifactual culture is intriguing. We know that the modern Homo sapiens brain was anatomically fully formed by no later than 100,000 years before the present. From that time forward, the material culture at first evolved slowly, later expanded, and then exploded. It passed from a handful of stone and bone tools at the beginning of the interval to agricultural fields and villages at the 90% mark, and then, in a virtual eye blink, to prodigiously elaborate technologies, example, 5 million patents so far in the United States alone. In essence, cultural evolution has followed an exponential trajectory. It leaves us with a mystery. When did symbolic language arise? And exactly how did it ignite the exponentiation of cultural evolution? Too bad, but this great puzzle of human paleontology seems insoluble, at least for the time being. To pick up the trail of gene culture coevolution, it is better to defer reconstruction of the prehistoric record and proceed to the production of culture by the contemporary human brain. The next best approach, I believe, is to search for the basic unit of culture. Although no such element has yet been identified, at least to the general satisfaction of experts, its existence and some of its characteristics can be reasonably inferred. Such a focus may seem at first contrived and artificial, but it has many worthy precedents. The great success of the natural sciences has been achieved substantially by the reduction of each physical phenomenon to its constituent elements, followed by the use of the elements to reconstitute the holistic properties of the phenomenon. Advances in the chemistry of macromolecules, for example, led to the exact characterization of genes, and the study of population biology based on genes has refined our understanding of biological species. What then, if anything, is the basic unit of culture? Why should it be supposed even to exist? Consider first the distinction made by the Canadian neuroscientist Endel Tulving in 1972 between episodic and semantic memory. Episodic memory recalls the direct perception of people and other concrete entities through time, like images seen in a motion picture. Semantic memory, on the other hand, recalls meaning by the connection of objects and ideas to other objects and ideas, either directly by their images held in episodic memory or by the symbols denoting the images. Of course, semantic memory originates in episodes and almost invariably causes the brain to recall other episodes. But the brain has a strong tendency to condense repeated episodes of a kind into concepts, which are then represented by symbols. Thus, "proceed to the airport this way" yields to a silhouette of an airplane and arrow, and "this substance is poisonous" becomes a skull and crossbones on the side of a container. With the two forms of memory distinguished, the next step in the search for the unit of culture is to envision concepts as nodes or reference points in semantic memory that ultimately can be associated with neural activity in the brain. Concepts and their symbols are usually labeled by words. Complex information is thus organized and transmitted by language composed of words. Nodes are almost always linked to other nodes, so that to recall one node is to summon others. This linkage, with all the emotional coloring pulled up with it, is the essence of what we refer to as meaning. The linkage of nodes is assembled as a hierarchy to organize information with more and more meaning. Hound, hare, and chasing are nodes, each symbolizing collectively a class of more or less similar images. A hound chasing a hare is called a proposition, the next order of complexity in information. The higher order above the proposition is the schema. A typical schema is Ovid's telling of Apollo's courtship of Daphne. Like an unstoppable hound in pursuit of an unattainable hare, wherein the dilemma is resolved when Daphne, the hare and a concept, turns into a laurel tree, another concept reached by a proposition. I have faith that the unstoppable neuroscientists will encounter no such dilemma. In due course, they will capture the physical basis of mental concepts through the mapping of neural activity patterns. They already have direct evidence of spreading activation of different parts of the brain during memory search. In the prevailing view of the researchers, new information is classified and stored in a similar manner. When new episodes and concepts are added to memory, they are processed by a spreading search through the limbic and cortical systems, which establishes links with previously created nodes. The nodes are not spatially isolated centers connected to other isolated centers. They are typically complex circuits of large numbers of nerve cells deployed over wide, overlapping areas of the brain. Suppose, for example, you are handed an unfamiliar piece of fruit. You automatically classify it by its physical appearance, smell, taste, and the circumstances under which it is given. A large amount of information is activated within seconds, not just the comparison of the fruit in hand with other kinds, but also the emotional feelings, recollections of previous discoveries of similar nature, and memories of dietary customs that seem appropriate. The fruit, all its characteristics compounded, is given a name. Consider the durian of Southeast Asia, regarded by aficionados as the greatest of all tropical fruits. It looks like a spiny grapefruit, tastes sweet with a transient custard-like nuance, and when held away from the mouth, smells like a sewer. The experience of a single piece establishes, I assure you, the concept durian for a lifetime. The natural elements of culture can be reasonably supposed to be the hierarchically arranged components of semantic memory encoded by discrete neural circuits awaiting identification. The notion of a culture unit, the most basic element of all, has been around for over 30 years and has been dubbed by different authors variously as nemotype, idea, idene, meme, sociogene, concept, culture gen, and culture type. The one label that has caught on the most, and for which I now vote to be winner, is meme, introduced by Richard Dawkins in his influential work, The Selfish Gene, in 1976. The definition of meme, I suggest, is nevertheless more focused and somewhat different from that of Dawkins. It is the one posed by the theoretical biologist Charles J. Lumsden and myself in 1981 when we outlined the first full theory of gene culture coevolution. We recommended that the unit of culture, now called meme, be the same as the node of semantic memory and its correlates in brain activity. The level of the node, whether concept, the simplest recognizable unit, proposition, or schema, determines the complexity of the idea, behavior, or artifact that it helps to sustain in the culture at large. I realize that with advances in the neurosciences and psychology, the notion of node as meme, and perhaps even the distinction between episodic and semantic memory, are likely to give way to more sophisticated and complex taxonomies. I realize also that the assignment of the unit of culture to neuroscience might seem at first an attempt to short-circuit semiotics, the formal study of all forms of communication. That objection would be unjustified. My purpose in this exposition is the opposite, to establish the plausibility of the central program of consilience. In this instance, the causal connections between semiotics and biology. If the connections can be established empirically, then future discoveries concerning the nodes of semantic memory will correspondingly sharpen the definition of memes. Such an advance will enrich, not replace, semiotics. I concede that the very expression, genes to culture, as the conceptual keystone of the bridge between science and the humanities, has an ethereal feel to it. How can anyone presume to speak of a gene that prescribes culture? The answer is that no serious scientist ever has. The web of causal events comprising gene-culture coevolution is more complicated and immensely more interesting. Thousands of genes prescribe the brain, the sensory system, and all the other physiological processes that interact with the physical and social environment to produce the holistic properties of mind and culture. Through natural selection, the environment ultimately selects which genes will do the prescribing. For its implications throughout biology and the social sciences, no subject is intellectually more important. All biologists speak of the interaction between heredity and environment. They do not, except in laboratory shorthand, speak of a gene causing a particular behavior, and they never mean it literally. That would make no more sense than its converse, the idea of behavior arising from culture without the intervention of brain activity. The accepted explanation of causation from genes to culture, as from genes to any other product of life, is not heredity alone. It is not environment alone. It is interaction between the two. Of course it is interaction, but we need more information about interaction in order to encompass gene-culture coevolution. The central clarifying concept of interactionism is the norm of reaction. The idea is easily grasped as follows. Choose a species of organism, whether animal, plant, or microorganism. Select either one gene or a group of genes that act together to affect a particular trait. Then list all the environments in which the species can survive. The different environments may or may not cause variation in the trait prescribed by the selected gene or group of genes. The total variation in the trait in all the survivable environments is the norm of reaction of that gene or group of genes in that species. The textbook case of a norm of reaction is leaf shape in the arrow leaf, an amphibious plant. When an individual of the species grows on the land, its leaves resemble arrowheads. When it grows in shallow water, the leaves at the surface are shaped like lily pads, and when submerged in deeper water, the leaves develop as eelgrass-like ribbons that sway back and forth in the surrounding current. No known genetic differences among the plants underlie this extraordinary variation. The three basic types are variations in the expression of the same group of genes caused by different environments. Together, they compose the norm of reaction of the genes prescribing leaf form. They embrace, in other words, the full variation in expression of the genes in all known survivable environments. When some of the variation within a species is due to differences in genes possessed by separate members of the species, and not just different environments, norms of reaction can still, in principle, be defined for each of the genes or set of genes in turn. The relation of variation in a trait to variation in genes and their norms of reaction is illustrated by human body weight. There is abundant evidence that body form is influenced by heredity. A person genetically predisposed to obesity by heredity can diet to moderate slimness, although he is prone to slide back when off the diet. A hereditarily slender person, on the other hand, is likely to stay that way, and only persistent overeating or endocrine imbalance can push him into obesity. The relevant genes of the two individuals have different norms of reaction. They produce different results when both individuals occupy identical environments, including diet and exercise. The more familiar way to express the matter is in reverse, noting that hereditarily distinct individuals require different environments, in particular, different diets and regimes of exercise, in order to produce the same result. The same kind of interaction between genes and environment occurs in every category of human biology, including social behavior. In his important 1996 work, Born to Rebel, the American social historian Frank J. Sulloway has demonstrated that people respond powerfully during personality development to the order in which they were born, and thus the roles they assume in family dynamics. Later-borns, who identify least with the roles and beliefs of the parents, tend to become more innovative and accepting of political and scientific revolutions than do first-borns. As a result, they have, on average, contributed more than firstborns have to cultural change throughout history. They do it by gravitating toward independent, often rebellious roles, first within the family, and then within society at large. Because first and later borns do not differ genetically in any way correlated with their birth order, the genes influencing development can be said to spread their effects among various niches available in the environment. The birth order effect documented by Sulloway is their norm of reaction. In some categories of biology, such as the most elementary molecular processes and properties of gross anatomy, almost everyone has the same genes affecting traits in these categories, and hence the same norms of reaction. Long ago in geological time, when the truly universal traits were evolving, there probably was variation in the prescribing genes, but natural selection has since narrowed the variation almost to zero. All primates, for example, have 10 fingers and 10 toes, and there is virtually no variation due to environment, so the norm of reaction is exactly the single state of 10 fingers and 10 toes. In most categories, however, people differ genetically to a considerable degree, even in traits consistent enough to be regarded as cultural universals. In order to make the most of the variation, to cultivate health and talent, and realize human potential, it is necessary to understand the roles of both heredity and environment. By environment, I do not mean merely the immediate circumstances in which people find themselves. A snapshot will not suffice. The required meaning is that used by developmental biologists and psychologists. It is nothing less than the myriad influences that shape body and mind step by step throughout every stage of life. Because human beings cannot be bred and reared under controlled conditions like animals, information about the interaction of genes and environment comes hard. Relatively few genes affecting behavior, some of which I will describe later, have been located on chromosomes, and the exact pathways of development they influence have seldom been traced. In the interim, the preferred measure of interaction is heritability, the percentage of variation in the trait due to heredity. Heritability does not apply to individuals. It is used only for populations. It is incongruous to say this marathoner's athletic ability is 20% due to his genes and 80% to his environment. It is correct to make a statement such as, to use an imaginary example, 20% of the variation in performance of Kenyan marathoners is due to their heredity and 80% to their environment. For the listener who would like more precise definitions of heritability and variance, the measure of variation used by statisticians and geneticists, I will add them here. Heritability, minus mathematical refinements, is estimated as follows. In a sample of individuals from the population, measure the trait in a standardized way, say, aerobic performance on a treadmill, to represent endurance. Take the variation in the measure among the individuals in the sample and estimate the amount of the variation due to heredity. That fraction is the heritability. The measure of variation used is the variance. To get it, first take the average score obtained from individuals in the sample. Subtract each individual score in turn from the average and square the difference. The variance is the average of all the squared differences. The principal method of estimating the fraction of variation due to the genes, the heritability, is by studies of twins. Identical twins, which have exactly the same genes, are compared with fraternal twins, which, on average, share only the same number of genes as the number shared by siblings born at different times. Fraternal twins are consistently less alike than identical twins, and the difference between pairs of fraternal twins and pairs of identical twins serves as an approximate measure of the contribution of heredity to the overall variation in the trait. The method can be considerably enhanced by studies of those special pairs of identical twins who were separated in infancy and adopted by different families, thus possessing the same heredity but reared in different environments. It is further improved by multiple correlation studies in which the key environmental influences are identified and their contributions to the overall variation individually assessed. Heritability has been a standard measure for decades in plant and animal breeding. It has gained recent controversial attention for its human applications through The Bell Curve, the 1994 book by Richard J. Herrnstein and Charles Murray, and other popular works on the heredity of intelligence and personality. The measure has considerable merit and, in fact, is the backbone of human behavioral genetics. But it contains oddities that deserve close attention with reference to the consilience between genetics and the social sciences. The first is the peculiar twist called genotype-environment correlation, which serves to increase human diversity beyond the ambit of its immediate biological origins. The twist works as follows. People do not merely select roles suited to their native talents and personalities. They also gravitate to environments that reward their hereditary inclinations. Their parents, who possess similar inborn traits, are also likely to create a family atmosphere nurturing development in the same direction. The genes, in other words, help to create a particular environment in which they will find greater expression than would otherwise occur. The overall result is a greater divergence of roles within societies due to the interaction of genes and environment. For example, a musically gifted child receiving encouragement from adults may take up an instrument early and spend long hours practicing. His classmate, innately thrill-seeking, persistently impulsive and aggressive, is drawn to fast cars. The first child grows up to be a professional musician. The second, if he stays out of trouble, a successful racing car driver. The hereditary differences in talent and personality between the classmates may be small, but their effects have been amplified by the diverging pathways into which they were guided by the differences. To put genotype-environment correlation in a phrase, heritability, measured at the level of biology, reacts with the environment to increase heritability measured at the level of behavior. Understanding genotype-environment correlation clarifies a second principle of the relation of genes to culture. There is no gene for playing the piano well, or even a particular Rubinstein gene for playing it extremely well. There is instead a large ensemble of genes whose effects enhance manual dexterity, creativity, emotive expression, focus, attention span, and control of pitch, rhythm, and timbre. All of these together compose the special human ability that the American psychologist Howard Gardner calls musical intelligence. The combination also inclines the gifted child to seize the right opportunity at the right time. He tries a musical instrument, likely provided by musically gifted parents, is then reinforced by deserved praise, repeats, is reinforced again, and soon embraces what is to be the central preoccupation of his life. Another important peculiarity of heritability is its flexibility. By simply changing the environment, the percentage of variation due to heredity can be increased or decreased. Scores for heritability in IQ and measurable personality traits in white Americans, a segment of population typically chosen for convenience and in order to increase statistical reliability by making the sample more uniform mostly fall around the 50% mark, at least closer to it than to 0 or 100%. Do we wish to change these numbers? I think not, at least not as a primary goal. Imagine the result if a society became truly egalitarian, so that all children were raised in nearly identical circumstances and encouraged to enter any occupation they chose within reach of their abilities. Variation in environment would thus be drastically reduced, while the original innate abilities and personality traits endured.